We need to be aware of the societal roots of discrimination and trauma that lead to mental health. We need to challenge the ideas about mental illness that lead to isolation and stigma.
Looking at, listening to, and being on the receiving end of all of the discourses around mental health and mental illness, it's impossible not to notice the extent to which there seems to be a tension between mental illness as a problem to treat and as an experience from which to draw meaning. And so much of what people have to say on the subject is fundamentally about whether treatment can in some sense impinge upon and even do violence to meaning. And nowhere is this clearer than when it comes to the issue of psychosis and all of the different ways there are of both defining, talking about, and then urging that others respond to psychosis. Our guest today is Dr. Neely Myers, an associate professor of anthropology at SMU, recently co-author of a blog post with our own Dr. Martinez, "We Are Failing Young Adults with Psychosis." And much of her work kind of exists along this fault line between treatment, the headlong rush to intervene, and trying to extract meaning from what it is that young adults who present with psychosis are experiencing or have experienced. And so she's here with us today to expound upon some of the points that she made in the op-ed, which can now be found on the Hogg blog if you go to our website, and what she thinks is the best and most helpful framing of this issue. And so, Dr. Neely Myers, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So this op-ed that you recently co-wrote with our Dr. Martinez, "We Are Failing Young Adults with Psychosis." Who is we, and why the focus on young adults?
Well, for this particular op-ed, we refers to everyone. So it has been my finding in research that we are all complicit in ignoring the situation with mental health care in the United States. We know that 1 in 4 adults experience mental illness. So if you ask a general audience, almost everyone is connected to or knows someone with a mental health concern. But we also know that when people seek out help, they often receive the wrong kind, they're approached with the wrong message, or they don't receive any response. There's very limited funding and support, and we have very poor continuity of care. The focus on young adults is important because it's also been found in the research that young adults are usually at the beginning of their experience of mental health issues and concerns. And so they are still connected to their families. They are still in school. They are still employed. And their chance of recovering from this point of optimal social conditions is a lot higher than it would be if they start to fall through the cracks and become disconnected from families and jobs and schools and friends and things along those lines.
So what does the evidence say about early intervention?
Well, the evidence suggests that psychosis anyway is the recent models are suggesting that psychosis looks something like cancer. So we know that cancer progresses along a continuum and that if we intervene early in cancer, that we can create optimal outcomes. So this model logically is translating over into care for psychosis. And what we can see is that if we intervene early in the best possible way, young people are having better outcomes. Sometimes in some of the more optimal programs in Europe, we're seeing young people recovering, returning to a life that's completely fulfilling and what would be expected for them at a rate of about 80%. Versus something more like 30% here in the United States. And this kind of care requires very low dose medication, direct family involvement, supporting young people and to stay in school and to remain employed, offering them individual therapy, things along those lines that we just don't see happening here in the U.S.
So what is it that you think happens in the brain of someone who responds well to early intervention? And why would that window be so critical?
Well, I think that the research suggests that it's more what doesn't happen in the brain. So we know that there are so many neurally damaging processes that can happen for people after they receive a diagnosis of serious mental illness, and the fallout of the repercussions of that diagnosis. So things like social isolation from being stigmatized, losing one's job, becoming disconnected from school, the potentially toxic effects of long-term antipsychotic use and the side effects that they cause, including neurological tics, like in the case of tardive dyskinesia, self-medicating for relief, which we know can really complicate outcomes. And of course, the experience of depression and anxiety that can come along with having this stress reaction that is so alienating for people. So it's less, it's more of a prevention. We're trying to stop these negative downstream consequences of poor care up front with strong and appropriate early intervention.
Okay. And so, the behavior of individuals experiencing a psychotic break, I don't have to tell you, can be frightening and alienating for both the individual suffering and whoever is thrust into the role of providing care for that person. So how much patience do you think that there is for non-coercive approaches?
Okay, so there should be more patients for non-coercive approaches because there's evidence that young people are much more likely to follow up with care, with mental health providers, with peer services, with whatever they're seeking if they have a positive experience at the front end. So a lot of the young people have not had a positive experience at the front end. They've come to the psychiatric emergency room through the police, a police intervention or some kind of negative experience that has been traumatic for them. And a large group of researchers who are looking at alternatives to that kind of crash pad landing into the mental health system. Many people are advocating for soft landings, the use of diversion programs where a person is picked up by a group of peers who've had a similar experience. If you think of it somewhat like if you're having a bad acid trip, you don't want to be around someone who's never had that experience before. A lot of people with mental illnesses are describing it similarly. They want to be around people who recognize what they're going through and that kind of comfort is the sort of connection they need. Another way that would be very non-coercive would be we don't let people get to the point of crisis. So if we worked with educators and with pastors and with imams and other religious leaders and with families to help them recognize when a young person is really starting to edge into the territory of maybe needing even some basic connection to someone who's been there before, like a peer support specialist who could help them navigate these early moments in a way that prevents them from having a crisis and needing emergency care or police intervention.
So it really seems that your framing of the issue effectively complicates the story of psychosis as plain and simply a brain disease that more or less strikes without warning.
I definitely support the idea that psychosis may have, although we haven't, directly pinned down any direct causal pathway in genetics. But it does seem like some people have a genetic vulnerability or a tendency in their family to react to stress in a certain kind of way that may not be the best way for them to be responding. But it seems from the research that this is not random, that a lot of people who experience psychosis have a genetic vulnerability or a family tendency, but they also have experienced many social and environmental factors that contribute to the development of psychosis, like living in an urban area versus a rural area, or being bullied, or having parents who experience unemployment, or the experience of migration, especially interestingly, being a second generation immigrant. All kinds of adverse childhood events, the research shows, can accumulate in a young person's life to greatly elevate their risk of developing psychosis.
Okay, so along with the blog post that we've been talking about, you've also recently written a book, Recovery's Edge, an Ethnography of Mental Health Care and Moral Agency.
What story does this book tell, and what was your approach to writing it?
So this book tells the story of 3 years that I spent in a large urban psychosocial rehabilitation service in the Midwestern United States, and spending time at multiple levels of this agency. So I spent time at the administrative level and programs that the agency offered. And then for an 18-month period, becoming part of a new experimental program that was peer run. So these are people who are people with lived experience of mental illness who are trying to offer care, compassionate care to people who are just, you know, developing mental illness or have been in the system for a while, service users. So this was all a public mental health setting. And my approach was novel. So I did not approach it as a care provider. I approached it as a student and a researcher, but someone who was very consciously trying to live the life that the service users were living and to take on their perspective and really get to know them. So I didn't have any social power in the setting in terms of I wasn't in charge of anything. I wasn't volunteering. I did all the things that the service users did all day in this clubhouse setting. But I also found that it was a very supportive community and that people were thoughtful and wise by these very difficult lives that they were living. So this is a really compassionate on the ground perspective through really trying to look at this situation through the eyes of people using the services.
Okay. And my final question to you, mental health issues have now become a mainstay of mainstream media coverage and blogging. Not that, you know, people haven't always been fascinated by mental health and mental illness, especially, but it seems that there's been an uptick in the amount of published stories related to mental illness. And I suspect it was really the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting in late 2012 that probably given the credit, I guess, for this. And so what opportunities and challenges do you see with this heightened awareness of mental health?
Well, I think we're also seeing mental health diagnoses on the rise in our young people. Whether or not that's because people are screening more for it or because pharmaceutical companies are pushing for more prescriptions. There's so many potential factors leading into that. I also think there's sort of a grassroots way of talking about mental health. For example, young people sharing their stories on YouTube. If you Google, schizophrenia story, you might find young people sharing stories that could be very sort of comforting to people who are trying to learn more about the illness, who've just been diagnosed, who are experiencing unusual mental events themselves. So I think there's a potential positive effect of raising public awareness and of people realizing, okay, me too, I have this too, other people have this too, I'm not alone. And I think the challenge both on the public policy level and on the, local knowledge level is to keep the conversation from becoming over-medicalized. So it's not clear that medical intervention is the key to recovery. And we can't just throw a pill at the problems that people have. There's so many more environmental factors that lead into a serious mental health crisis. And there's social and environmental ways that we can help people address the crises once they've arisen, or like I mentioned earlier, possibly try and prevent them. So we need to be aware of the societal roots of discrimination and trauma that lead to mental health. We need to challenge the ideas about mental illness that lead to isolation and stigma, and try and fight back against that stigma and let young people know that they reach out and they share their stories, that they will find other people having the same struggle. And that it doesn't have to just be something that's handled by a doctor in a hospital. It's a conversation that we can have in the community and that really needs to be addressed in a way that promote recovery.
Okay, so the book, Recovery's Edge, an Ethnography of Mental Health Care and Moral Agency, and the blog post, which you can still find on our Hog blog, We Are Failing Young Adults with Psychosis. Dr. Neely Myers, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Getting back to this theme, the tension between treatment and meaning, this next segment features Dr. Pat Deegan, a nationally known speaker and advocate for the mental health recovery movement. This is from a four-part interview that we videotaped and can now be found on the Hogg Foundation YouTube page from 2014. That same year, she delivered the keynote address at our biannual Robert Lee Sutherland Seminar. In this segment, Deegan talks about her own experiences being diagnosed with schizophrenia at a very young age, and how, in the decades since, she's been able to extract meaning from her own experience of illness, or what most would label as illness, and then recovery. And so this segment, Becoming Dr. Deegan.
My experience was that the medications were as disabling as the disorder was. I was 17 years old and a senior in high school. I had an acute psychotic break, and within relatively short order, my family put me in a mental hospital. And basically at the time, I was told I had schizophrenia. I was told that I needed to retire from life, that I needed to avoid stress, that I needed simply to take large doses of antipsychotic medications for the rest of my life, and basically retire from living at the ripe old age of 17 years old. For me, that was a prognosis of doom. But in the beginning, you know, I was young, and I said, well, they're the doctors, they know, right? So this sounds serious. You know, I'd seen One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and I was like, whoa, they're saying this is what it's all going to be about for me. And every week I would go in to see the psychiatrist, and he'd say, you're taking your meds? And I'd say, I'm taking the meds. And he said, good, you're doing good for a schizophrenic. And it just kind of shows you what very low expectations they had for me in my life. And finally, I kind of got up the guts and I said, what's wrong with me? What do I have, you know? And then he went into this sort of rap that just sort of flowed, and he said, you have a disease called schizophrenia. It's a disease that's a lot like diabetes, just like a diabetic is going to have to take medications for the rest of their life. You're going to have to take psychiatric meds, antipsychotics for the rest of your life. Maybe you can cope. I really want to encourage you to go into this halfway house. And as he was going on about that, I felt the ember of something just sort of flare up inside of me. And I call that moment just one of angry indignation, because at the heart of that word indignation is the word dignity. I felt it come up, and just something inside of me was just going, no, you are wrong about me. You are wrong about me. But by then I was pretty socialized into the role of being a mental patient. So I didn't speak up, you know, for fear that, you know, they'd put me back in the hospital or something, you know, raise my meds. Instead, I went out into the corridor after the appointment, and I remember just, you're wrong about me. And I'm saying this to myself, and then this thought comes into my head, and the thought is, in fact, you're so wrong that I'm going to become Dr. Deegan, and I'm going to change the mental health system so no one ever gets hurt in it again. And, you know, it's not like the clouds opened up and the angels came down from on high and I was, you know, on my way. In fact, absolutely nothing from the outside changed. But inside, I experienced this kind of turning point where now I knew what I needed to do. But it wasn't enough, you know. It needed to be followed by some kind of action. So the way that happened for me is I had this little Irish grandmother who lived with our family growing up. And she would come in every day to the room where I sat, and we were smoking my cigarettes and stuff, and she would say, Patricia, would you like to go food shopping? And I would say, no. She'd say, Patricia, and she'd come in the next day, Patricia, would you like to go food shopping? And every day. And I should have caught on, because she would come in on Sundays when the grocery stores weren't open. But she was a wise old woman, and she said every day she would invite me. And one day, months down the road, for reasons I can't tell you why, I said yes, adding the caveat that I'd only, you know, push the cart, wouldn't put anything in it. But that was actually the first active step I took in my recovery, pushing a grocery cart down the aisle of a grocery store. And I learned, it dawned on me, like, oh yeah, if I'm going to become Dr. Deegan and change the mental health system so no one ever gets hurt in it again, maybe I should think about trying out college. You know, oh yeah. So I took one course at a local community college, went to the hospital in the middle of that semester, got back out, came back to class. I just kept at it, you know. I struggled a lot with distressing voices. Nobody was talking about recovery at the time. So all I knew was I had this call and I was saying yes to it. I was going to keep going. And I would bring a tape recorder, the old analog tape recorders with me, you know, a Sony Walkman, put one of those receivers on it and record the lectures. And when I felt better later in the day, maybe be able to comprehend some of it. My goal in sitting in a class was just to get through without freaking out, you know? But slowly but surely, it was like practice and trying out different things of how not to freak out and how to stay attuned and how to pay attention and concentrate again when my mind would be running. So, slowly but surely, I did it. I did become Dr. Deegan and got a doctorate in clinical psychology, and that's how I got into the mental health field. Bit of a story.
So that does it for this episode of Into the Fold. As always, if you have any ideas or suggestions for podcast topics, don't be shy about reaching out to us. My email address, imani.evans@austin.utexas.edu. Imani is spelled I-M-A-N-I. If you're interested in checking out Dr. Myers' book, Recovery's Edge, you can find it pretty easily on Amazon.com. And that does it. This is Ike Evans of Hogg Foundation for Mental Health. Thanks so much for joining us.